Well, today is an exciting day for all of us associated with Focus on the Family. I'm very delighted to make this announcement. Dr. James Dobson, our host and the president of Focus on the Family, has just written a brand new book. I say that almost tongue-in-cheek because I know it takes years for that to take place, but he's just finished a new book. How do you feel after just giving birth?
I feel like I've just gone through labor pains of one sort or another, Gil. Winston Churchill said it best a number of years ago. He said, writing a book is an adventure. To begin with, it's a toy and an amusement, and then it becomes a mistress, and then it becomes a master, and then it becomes a tyrant. And the last phase is just as you're about to become reconciled to its servitude, you kill the monster and fling him about to the public. And that expresses my sentiment exactly. I've just killed the monster, and I'm about to inflict him on my unsuspecting friends.
What kind of title have you put to the book?
We call it Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives, and it's addressed to the role of men today and what I think God wants of husbands and fathers.
What were the circumstances that made the book relevant and necessary to your way of thinking?
Gil, some fascinating things are happening right now to men in the Western world. But to explain it, I need to back up and talk about women, because you can't understand the present situation without looking at the immediate past.
You're referring, I imagine, to the whole woman's movement, the feminist movement of the last few years.
That's right. It's had a tremendous impact on both men and women. And for the past 15 years, there's been a concerted effort by the media, and by feminists, certainly, to change the way society sees women and the way women see themselves. Every element in the traditional concept of femininity has been attacked and mocked and vilified in recent years, especially those aspects relating to homemaking or raising children. The traditional American values, Gil, have been the flag and the motherhood and apple pie. And we burned the flag in the 60s, and we attacked motherhood in the 70s. And the way I got it figured, the 80s are going to be bad
Real
news for apple
tough
pie.
Tough on apple pie. To what do you attribute the attack that's taking place on traditional female roles? I know you've addressed it many times, but refresh our memories.
It certainly is no random drift of social values, Gil. The change in attitude was carefully orchestrated and is being carefully orchestrated, especially by the media. I've made reference a number of times to a particular program that I saw on television. I believe it was 1974. It was done on NBC, prime time, by Barbara Walters and Tom Snyder. They were the hosts of the program, and they devoted it to the world of women. The whole program was devoted to the thesis, what's going on in the world of women today? And their purpose, supposedly, was to show women in all the different pursuits and the different responsibilities and occupations and kind of update the world of women. But in 3 hours of primetime programming, Gil, I taped it and I listened to it two or three times. In 3 hours, never one time did they give any attention or even mention the role of the homemaker in that responsibility, despite the fact that there may be 30 million women in this country who are given to that responsibility. It was never mentioned.
And despite the fact that that role is changing, too, there are new ways of going
certainly
about the job of being a home economist and a mother. They gave no attention to that at all.
They allowed it to come up occasionally in a derogatory way or to make it look like something passé. But never once did they really focus in on somebody who was doing that job and wanted to do that job and loved doing that job and felt fulfilled doing that
right,
job.
Right, and present her in an attractive manner.
And women get the message. They hear this. Now, that's just one example that I grabbed hold of. Almost every night on television, you could take another one. We could give 500 examples of that nature. Women are beginning to recognize that the responsibility of the homemaker is being disrespected, by somebody at least. And that creates all kinds of pressures for the woman who's in that role.
If it is a massive media campaign, do you think it's a witting or unwitting one?
There isn't any doubt about it in my mind, Gil. It's a conscious campaign to change the whole image of women. Look at other television shows in recent years, and it's an attempt to, again, change the way women see themselves and the way we see women.
Right. You're saying in your new book you address this change and describe, do you, the new woman that's coming into focus?
In fact, let me go back to a prior book and read you something that I wrote about this exact topic. I said the image of women now being depicted by the media is a ridiculous combination of wide-eyed fantasy and feminist propaganda. Today's woman is always shown as gorgeous, of course, but she's more, much more. She roars around the countryside in a racy sports car while her male companion sits on the other side of the front seat, anxiously biting his nails. She exudes self-confidence from the very tips of her fingers, and for good reason. She could dismantle any man alive with her karate chops and flying kicks to the teeth. She is deadly accurate with a pistol, and she plays tennis or football like a pro. She speaks in perfectly organized sentences as though her spontaneous remarks were being planned and written by a team of tiny English professors sitting in the back of her pretty head. She's a sexual gourmet, to be sure, but she wouldn't be caught dead in a wedding ceremony. She has the grand good fortune of being perpetually young, and she never becomes ill, nor does she ever make a mistake or appear foolish. In short, she is virtually omniscient, except for a curious inability to do anything traditionally feminine, such as cook, sew, or raise children. Truly, today's screen heroine is a remarkable specimen, standing proud and uncompromising with wide stance and hands on her hips. Oh, yeah, this baby's come a long, long way. No doubt about that.
Question is forwards or backwards? This is not a new trend. We're not talking about something that happened last year. Do you detect any noticeable effects on our society as a result of this attack on the traditional feminine role?
Gil, I think it's produced a decade of intense self-doubt in women as they struggle for a new sense of identity. None of the old values seemed to float all of a sudden, but there were no new ones to grab hold of. And especially women who perceive themselves as being stranded in a traditional role. Have experienced low self-esteem and depression and great anger and a desperate desire to escape. Gil, do you get the point now? Here is a woman who has small children, and they are her responsibility. She wants that responsibility. She's taking care of them, and she's raising them. And all at once, in come all these messages that say, what you're doing is unworthy of your time. You're being cheated, shortchanged, exploited, taken advantage of, and you really ought to get that monkey off your back and get out and do something meaningful. She hears that all around her, on television, radio, in books, everything. Everybody seems to say it to her. She perceives herself being the object of disrespect, but she also perceives herself as being trapped there. You can't just dump those kids, and she loves those kids. And what do? So she remains there, but in a sense of great agitation and depression and low self-esteem. And there is no agitation like feeling like you're disrespected and unloved and unwanted and unneeded and uncared for.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is a waste of time, and life is passing you by.
Yeah, it's hard enough to do the work itself, let alone to carry the burden of feeling that the work is meaningless.
That's correct. And yeah. I think the effect of this attempt to change the concept of women, not just to open doors to women in the business world, which is another matter altogether, but I'm talking about those who have the traditional feminine role being made to feel that it's a waste of time and they're being cheated because of it.
All right, again, this is not a new phenomenon. Women have had years now to struggle with these messages. Where do you see us on the continuum? Do you think women are beginning to come to terms with these agitating voices?
I think so, Gil. A certain percentage of women have accepted the new image for themselves as executive, as business person, as athlete, or at least as individuals whose world is much wider than the home. A smaller percentage has determined to hold on to those traditional values of homemaker, wound patcher, meal fixer, sock mender, helpmeet to the husband, and mother to the kids. So there are those who have kind of settled into these two concepts, these two aspects of self-image, and I think there's less agitation today because of it.
Well, listening to us talk, are you sure you wrote your new book about men? It sounds like you wrote it about women.
That's all the background that leads up to it, Gil, because a fascinating thing is now happening. The chaos and self-doubt that was very evident in the world of women just a few years ago has now, would you believe it, spread to men, which should have been anticipated. You can't create havoc in half the population without it spreading to the other half sooner or later.
At least that's the background that leads to the book. It's the reason that the book was written, the reason that I felt it was necessary. What I actually tried to do in the book is to redefine masculinity from the point of view of the Christian perspective. What does it mean to be a man? Attitudes and relationships are changing. Will a man march off to defend his homeland in times of war? Will he fight on foreign soil, or will his wife go do it for him? Should a man wear jewelry? Some do. Satin shoes? Carry a purse? Now, what I'm really saying, Gil, is that is there anything that marks a man as different from his female counterpart? I think if you listen to the media, there's just not much that's left that makes us different from one another, and I think that's a mistake.
You know, I don't think you're describing an extreme situation. I don't think you're pushing this to the extreme at all. I experience exactly what you're talking about. I have worked in offices with women executives where, honestly, you don't know what is right and what is wrong. I've gone to lunch with them for a business luncheon, and you don't know whether to hold the car door for them or whether, in fact, they will take offense at your not being sensitive enough to know that that's a put-down.
That's just my point, Gil. We're in a state of transition today. The relationship between the sexes is changing. The attitude toward our sexual identity is changing. And in this in-between period, we're in a state of great confusion along with it. First, it began with women, and now there's quite a bit of evidence to indicate that men are the ones that are going through the difficult times. There was an article in Psychology Today a while back written by James Levine, and he was reviewing three new books that had come out on the subject of men. And in the preface to the article, he made this quote: "After countless books about the condition of women that have been published in the last decade, we're now getting a spate of studies about men. One theme comes through loud and clear. The male is in crisis. Buffeted by the women's movement, constrained by a traditional and internalized definition of masculinity, men literally don't know who they are, what women want from them, or even what they want from themselves." Mm. That kind of says it.
So you're saying your book on this subject is not the only statement to the effect that there's a great deal of confusion out there.
There are literally hundreds of books that are coming out on this subject, most of which, however, are not written from a Christian perspective. I suppose if anything marks mine as different, that's it.
And again, if I understand you, you're saying that some of these changes in the traditional roles of men and some of the confusion that's resulting is not just haphazard, not just accidental, that there are actually forces at work bringing all of this about.
Gil, I'm absolutely convinced that this has been planned. It's been orchestrated, if you will. Maybe not by a group getting together and saying, let's have a conspiracy to change the way men see themselves, but there's been a campaign among the liberal press to change the way men and women see themselves. And so I see this confused sex role identity as anything but the result of a random social evolution. It's a product of deliberate efforts to discredit the traditional role of manliness by those who seek revolution within the family. You notice in the quote that I just gave by James Levine that he referred to traditional masculinity as constraining. Did you catch that? He said, buffeted by the women's movement, constrained, that means boxed in, by a traditional and internalized definition of masculinity. See, they see men as boxed in by that traditional view, and they want to break him free from that and give him some new kind of identity and new kind of role. And that is precisely the way the liberal media and the humanistic behavioral scientists have perceived the biblical concept of maleness. And in my book, I'm attempting to redefine that traditional role, not as constraining, not as locking us in, but as setting us free. Because it came from the creator of fatherhood, and he ought to understand a little something about how it should best function.
Time and time again on this program, we refer to the concept of humanism, or that attempt by man to make his own way through life. And we're back to it again, aren't we? We're talking about man's attempt to define what a man ought to be, which has gotten us, according to what you're saying, very far away from the original definitions handed down by God of what a man was to be.
Nearly all the ills of our society result from man saying, it does not matter about the Judeo-Christian ethic. It does not matter what is written in the Word of God. It does not matter what's been learned in centuries upon centuries of human existence. It's what seems right to me at this moment, and I will replace all of that prior wisdom that's been handed down with what appears to be true today on the basis of current thought. And that'll get you into trouble every time. And Dr. Schaefer said humanism always leads to chaos. And it does. It was a humanistic concept that led Adolf Hitler to say, Jews are not contributing, they are not worth anything, let's kill them all. That seemed perfectly reasonable to Germans at that time. That's a humanistic notion. It is disregarding the wisdom of the past, the wisdom of the Bible, wisdom of God, the wisdom of tradition. And it's saying what seems right today is right. And when you start tampering with something as basic as male and female roles with that kind of current thought, that kind of current wisdom, you're in deep trouble.
Well, can you project in your imagination on down the road a year or two or five if these trends continue? What do you see as some of the long-range implications of this attempt to redefine masculinity?
Well, a family is certain to suffer from it. When sexual identity is confused, then roles become blurred, and when roles become blurred, the smooth functioning of the family unit is disrupted. And when that occurs, needs are not met, especially the needs of little children.
And that's the message of your new book, Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives, I assume.
No, it's not, Bill, as a matter of fact. At least the book is not about the women's movement and the men's movement and how all this confusion has taken place. All that is merely the background. What we've been talking about to this point is not the main thrust of the book. It merely explains why I wrote the book. It's what led up to it, why the book was needed, why I felt it was necessary. The main purpose of the book is to redefine masculinity, to reestablish those traditional values and attitudes and functions that speak of maleness from a biblical point of view.
Can you describe a little of what directions then your mind went as you wrote the book?
Yes, I've tried to describe how a man relates to his world. I've talked about a man and his children, and a man and his wife, a man and his authority, a man in the straight life, in other words, that responsibility of day-by-day living, a man in his work, a man in his money, a man in his sexual identity, and in that chapter we get into some of the things you and I have been talking about, a man in his midlife years, dealing with the midlife crisis, a man in his emotions, a man in his animals, which is a fun chapter, and a man in his God, and finally, a man in his death.
I happen to know that it's a very emotional book as well, isn't it, as much of your writing is?
It is, Gil, more so than anything I've ever written. It was dedicated to my dad, who died in 1977. He was very close to me. He was my partner. He read everything that I wrote, and much of what I wrote originated in a conversation or from a letter from him, and he was my very good friend. And so the book is based on his life. He serves as the model for it, and his story is woven throughout it as well.
I know you feel intensely about all of your work in regard to the family, whether you're talking about toddlers or adolescents or women and various depressions that they encounter, or now men. Just how intensely do you feel about this particular book that you've just written?
Gil, I think it's the most important I've ever addressed or dealt with. You're aware, I know, of a prayer that I prayed several years ago asking the Lord to give me his message for the Christian family. As long as I was going to be speaking and writing on this subject, I might as well have his wisdom instead of depending on my own puny ideas and my insight and my knowledge and my awareness of what was going on. And I asked him specifically to tell me what he wanted me to convey. And his reply did not come with smoke and fire, thunder and lightning, but over a period of months I became aware that this was his message, that if the family in America is going to survive, it will be because husbands and fathers again began to put their families at the highest possible level on their system of priorities and to reserve something of their time, effort, and energy for those who depend on them there. So I really feel that fathers hold the keys. If we can get them excited about the family, it will make it. And if we can't, I don't think it will. I have an article here entitled Fathering Failure, Now Huge Problem. This was written by Joan Beck, who's a syndicated columnist. She said the statistics gnaw at the mind and tug at the heart. About 15% of American babies are now born without legal fathers.
Wow.
The highest percentage ever. That's 468,100 kids without a dad added to the illegitimacy rolls in 1 year alone. One child in seven misses out right from the beginning on what should be every youngster's birthright: a father's name, a father's caring and love, a father's financial and emotional support, a father's guidance and teaching, a father's example of what a man should be. Now, the problem of fathering is not limited only to those who sire children and leave. There are many absentee fathers and fathers who are involved outside the home to the exclusion of the needs of their children and the needs of their wives as well.
Yeah.
So I see it as a major issue that we need to address.
You were mentioning to me just before we went on the air today a comment by a gentleman by the name of Derek Prince. Why don't you repeat that?
Yes, I don't know Derek Prince. I've heard of him, and I've heard a tape that he made, which I think is fantastic, on fathering. And he made a statement in there that I'll never get away from. He said that it's his opinion that most of the woes and ills of this country result from what he called renegade males. And he defined a renegade as one who reneges, one who has reneged on his responsibility to provide leadership within his home, leadership in the form of financial integrity, not allowing his family to spend more money than they can afford and not getting into credit problems, leadership in the form of authority, taking the primary role, not the only role, but the primary role with regard to the discipline of the children. The Bible says he, speaking of the father, must have the proper authority with his own children. Leadership in spiritual matters. Who prays with the children at night? Who is it that gets them up and gets them to church on Sunday morning? Who is it that takes the primary responsibility for spiritual leadership in the home? Frequently it's the mother, and one of the greatest sources of agitation that I hear from mothers especially is that their husbands who claim to be Christians will not assume spiritual leadership in the home. And finally, leadership in terms of the relationship with the wife. It's the husband's responsibility to love his wife, even as Christ loved the church, giving his life for her. And Derek Prince said, our failure as men to accept that responsibility in the home is what's caused us most of our problems in society.
Well, then that provides an ample background, an ample motivation for writing your book. I can see the need that men have to come to grips with what it means to be a man and a
That's
father
right.
and a husband. We were talking earlier about the fact that it was difficult for you to address the question, what is a man? A little difficult to get your hand on that as you wrote the book. Talk about how you resolved that.
Well, I used my own father as a model, and I think the probably one of God's greatest blessings to me was giving me a father that I could identify with and model myself after. And he stands, even after his death, like a tower of strength to me, like a beacon to me, steering me past many of the rocks and the pitfalls that so many of my friends got into through the adolescent years. And so I've based the book on that very emotional relationship with my dad, and also my grandfather. And I think that the best way to explain a model of this nature is to talk about individuals, people that we admire.
Huh.
And the third chapter of the book actually describes my grandfather and my father and their relationship.
We're talking about Dr. Dobson's new book, Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives, if you just joined us. Read a little of it, would you? We've promised people a sampling of the book. And why don't you set it up first and then give us a little from that chapter.
All right, Gil. We don't often read material like this on the program, but maybe it'll be appropriate today. The portion that I'd like to read deals with the fact that in 1969, my father's two surviving brothers and his sister came to California for a family reunion. And these four family members now spent the better part of 5 days reminiscing and talking about their childhood, and especially their father. And it amazed me how they held him in awe and dignity and respect. All these years later, he died the year before I was born, which was 34 years prior to this family reunion. And yet they still spoke of him as though he were still alive. and I was fascinated by that and wondered what the ingredients were that made them respect him so. And so I asked them to explain it, and one of them said, he was a tower of strength, and the other one said, well, he had a certain dignity about him with appropriate gestures of the hand, and another one said, we held him in awe, but none of them could really identify what it was about him that made him such a tower of strength.
Yeah, specific characteristics.
That's right. Yeah. And it was only when we got into specific stories and incidents that the man really began to live again, and I began to see what they were talking about. And my dad provided the best evidence by writing the description of his dad's death. And so what I'm going to read you was not written by me at all, but written by my dad. And I think you'll appreciate this. These are the last days of my grandfather. The attack that took his life occurred when he was 69 years of age and resulted ultimately in the breakup of the family circle. For many years after his death, I could not pass Tri-State Hospital without noting one particular window. It stood out from all the rest, hallowed because it represented the room where he had suffered so much. The details of those tragic days and nights remain in my memory, unchanged by the passage of time. We had been 3 days and three nights practically without sleep, listening to him struggle for breath, hearing the sounds of approaching death, smelling the smells of death. Dad lay in a deep coma. His heavy breathing could be heard up and down the corridor. We walked the halls of that old hospital for hours, listening to the ceaseless struggle, which now was becoming fainter and fainter. Several times the nurse had called us in, and we had said the last goodbye, had gone through the agony of giving him up, only to have his heart rally, and then the endless vigil would begin all over again. Finally, we had gone into an adjoining room not prepared for sleep, but some in the chairs and some across the beds, we had fallen into the sleep of utter exhaustion. At 5 minutes to 4 o'clock, the nurse came in and awakened one of my twin brothers. Robert roused with a start. "Is he gone?" he asked. "No, but if you boys want to see your dad one more time while he's alive, you'd better come now." The word quickly passed around, and we filed into the room to stand around his bed for the last time. I remember that I stood at his left side. I smoothed back the hair from his forehead, and I laid my hand on his big old red hand, so very much like my own. I felt the fever that precedes death, 105. While I was standing there, a change came over me. Instead of being a grown man, I was 24 at the time. I became a little boy again. They say this often happens to adults who witness the death of a parent. I thought I was in the Union train station in Shreveport, Louisiana, in the late afternoon, and I was watching for his return. The old Kansas City Southern passenger train was backing into the station, and I saw it come round a curve. My heart swelled with pride. I turned to the little boy standing next to me and said, "You see that big man standing on the back of the train? One hand on the air brake and the other on the little whistle with which he signals the engineer. That big man is my dad." He set the air brake, and I heard the wheels grind to a stop. I saw him step off that last coach. I ran and jumped into his arms. I gave him a tight hug, and I smelled the train smoke on his clothes. "Daddy, I love you," I said. It all comes back. I patted that big hand and said, "Goodbye, Dad," as he was sinking fast now. "We haven't forgotten how hard you worked to send 5 boys and 1 girl through college. How you wore those old conductor uniforms until they were slick, doing without, that we might have things that we didn't really need." At 3 minutes to 4 o'clock, like a stately ship moving out of Time's Harbor into eternity's sea, he breathed his last. The nurse motioned us to leave and pulled the sheet over his head, a gesture that struck terror into my heart, and we turned with silent weeping to leave the room. Then an incident occurred that I will never forget. Just as we got to the door, I put my arm around my little mother and said, "Mama, this is awful." Dabbing at her eyes with her handkerchief, she said, "Yes, Jimmy, but there's one thing Mother wants you to remember now. We've said good night down here, but one of these days we're going to say good morning up there."
And I believe she did say good morning, too, 11 years later, and I know he met her just inside the Eastern Gate.
That's beautiful. That really is.
Gil, there's not much detail there about what made that man who he was and made the impact on his life. But you see the capacity of a father to influence children and the emotional ties that are there that remain unchanged by the passage of time. And I want to have that kind of impact on my children. And if I can model myself after my father and my grandfather, I'll feel that I have done the job well.
I think what you're saying is that as you struggled in your book to define a man, it didn't come to you just in crisp little phrases that you can list. Here are the 6 things, and if these are a part of your life, then you're a man. But rather, the answer to that question, what is a man, comes through looking around us at men who've modeled a strong Christian manhood before our eyes.
How in the world do you put character into a box or into a book? How do you put personality into words? If it were easy to do that, Jesus would not have had to come to show us the personality and the character of God. He had to come because we can only see it when it's modeled. We can only see it when we experience it in a relationship with another person. And it's the most difficult thing in the world to try to describe it. And I could only do it by describing people. My grandfather was not a Christian until 2 weeks before he died at 69 years of age. And yet he lived by an inflexible standard of morality throughout those years. At one point, when he was a younger man, he went into business with a colleague whom he later found out to not be honest, and he walked out and almost gave him the business. And that business is now a multi-million dollar affair throughout the South. You can see evidence of it in cities all over the South. But he gave it up and he never looked back because it wasn't right. He had a certain dignity and internal control that is missing so often today. And then when he added Christianity to the picture right before he died, it was a beautiful thing.
You know, I imagine that the reason you put this story of death in your book is because there's something about death that brings into sharp focus what a man was. I've heard you talk about your own dad's death. Am I not right? There was something about your father's death that crystallized the whole meaning of his life.
That is beautifully said, Gil, and death does have a way of putting all of life into proper perspective, because that's coming to all men. And the last chapter of the book deals with a man and his death. And again, it related to the death of my own father. And I try to describe how a good man dies. It ought to be different. A good man should die differently than a man who is dying without God. And I described the circumstances that surrounded my own dad's passing. And it's awful personal, but let me share something with you.
Do that.
Well, I had been down to San Antonio, Texas to speak to the Texas Pediatric Society, and Shirley was with me, and we got that phone call that said my dad had had a major myocardial infarction, a heart attack, a very bad heart attack, and that he was dying, and that they really didn't expect him to even live to the next morning. So Shirley and I were grief-stricken, and we ran to catch a plane and flew to Kansas City. And my dad did survive through that night. And 2 weeks later, he was still alive and in the hospital, and I came through to see him on the way from a speaking engagement, which turned out to be the last time I ever saw him alive. On that Sunday morning, he was exuberant. He was excited. It looked like the medical reports were good, and he was going to get to go home, and he was enthusiastic about life, and he had so much he wanted to learn and so much he wanted to read. And he said, "There's something that I really need to tell you." And he started crying. And he said, "I've had an experience that I need to convey to you that I haven't been able to tell anybody to this point." And he was just weeping by this point. And I said, "Dad, I'm really afraid that you're going to affect your heart. I think maybe we better talk about it a little later." And he said, "Okay, okay." And he dried his tears, and the conversation went on to other things. That was the last time I ever saw my dad alive, because he died before I got a chance to talk to him again. But he did tell my mother and another friend, Dr. Dean Baldwin, what it was that he was going to tell me that day. My dad had been lying in the hospital that night when he wasn't expected to live, the first night. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, he had an incredible experience. He said it was not an hallucination. It was not a dream.
He was transported into a large hall. He said, I was neither asleep nor awake, but he said, it was not a dreamlike state. I saw it. And he was very emphatic about it. And my dad was not given to mystical exaggeration. He just was not the kind that would do that. And he was weeping as he told my mother and our friend about this incident. And he said he realized that he was an observer there. He was not addressed. He was not even looked at. But he was there in that hall. And then he realized that it was a kind of divine proceeding that he was being allowed to sit in on. And over at the right was the most beautiful figure he had ever seen. The figure was never introduced. The person was not made known to him. He now believed him to be Jesus. And he was sitting at a table and he was writing. And he was writing the words. And my dad realized that it was his life that he was evaluating. And he put the pencil down and he began to speak to God on behalf of my dad, summarizing his life. And he said it was the most eloquent language he had ever heard, the most beautiful language, as he described the life that he had lived. And then he went back to his writing, and on the last line he pushed his hand outward and upward in this fashion as a way of saying, he is acceptable for time and eternity. And the vision was over. Now, I'll leave it to our listeners and my readers to draw their own conclusions about whether my dad experienced a drug-induced hallucination on that night, or if he was, in fact, permitted to witness the evaluation of his own life. But there's one thing of which I am absolutely certain, Gil. My dad was found acceptable, for he had lived for his Maker through those years and served as that model for me. And as I said before, he's been a beacon to me through those years, and especially his love for the Lord. I never saw him compromise that. In my years at home, where I could see him up close, where human foibles and frailties and dishonesty, nothing can be hidden, and I never saw him fail it, and I never saw him compromise.
Is there any message more important for we men than the message of capturing a godly vision of what a man can be?
All I know is this, Gil, that most of the pursuits that men devote their lives to, such as working 14 hours a day and trying to make money and trying to climb the ladder of success and trying to achieve and trying to make a name for ourselves and trying to build a house and all those earthly materialistic things are going to fade away. They don't mean a thing. What matters is what we've been talking about today. Those warm, beautiful relationships within the family that'll outlast us. You know, someone said the only way to live our lives is to invest it in something that will outlive us. And our children and others are the only thing we can take to heaven with us.
Yeah. And you know what? A brakeman on the back of a locomotive can give that heritage to a child, and the wealthiest individual who doesn't capture that vision can miss it.
Money and status have nothing to do with it, Gil.
Let's close the broadcast the same way you closed the book, shall we?
I close the book with a prayer, a personal prayer, again, intensely intimate. This is not just a way of closing a book. This is the prayer of my life, and this is what I said. Heavenly Father, I yearn to be the kind of father and husband that you desire of me. My highest ideal on this earth is to earn those words of approval, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Yet I feel so inadequate to discharge my responsibility properly. I know that my children's concept of you will be greatly influenced by how they perceive me, and that thought is terrifying. But I know that you only expect me to do the best that I can, and that thought is comforting. Thank you for the model you gave me in my father. Help me now to perpetuate that example before the children whom you have loaned to Shirley and me. And though I've said it before, keep the circle unbroken when we stand before your throne. Finally, Lord, would you also give my dad a brief message for me? Tell him that I love him. No son ever owed his father more.
Wow. I want to make that my prayer, too. This has been a very emotional program, and I wonder if I could ask you just one last question of a different nature just before we leave our friends for today. There are a lot of women who have heard you describe your new book and would very much like to read it themselves and also like to have their husbands read it, but they may wonder how to go about getting their husbands to read a book on men. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, Gil, in the first place, it's not just a book for men. The title is Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives, and I address women in the book, too. But secondly, it would be helpful if women could explain to their husbands that this is not a bludgeoning book. You know, this is a loving book. This is a book on feelings and character and the model that we've been talking about. It is not an angry book designed to increase guilt in husbands. And I think maybe if wives get into it, perhaps they can entice their husbands to enjoy it as well.
If you're a single adult, then you'll be especially interested in this next discussion on the frustrations of being single.
Dr. Dobson, I know you want to devote this program to all the unmarried adults who are listening to us today. That sounds fascinating.
Gil, the name of our program is Focus on the Family, and single adults represent a family of one, but they are families nonetheless.
And they do have needs and concerns and interests of their own.
Now, if there is an emphasis in this program that I want to try to get across, it is that very frequently those who are married, those who are into raising children and have family needs, are not aware of the problems that the single person faces. And I want to get other people into their world and help people experience what singles experience, walk in their shoes, feel what they feel, think what they think, and just for this time, to get behind the eyes of a single person and see what that experience is like.
All right. Where would you like to begin the discussion then?
Well, let's start with a letter that came a while back. This letter was mildly critical of us, and I think for some good reasons, because we do not have all the answers or even a complete understanding of this topic today. That's why I want to lean heavily on letters that have come today.
Good.
We often don't just read one letter right after another, but in this program, I think we need to let people who are there tell other people where they are and what their feelings are. So this letter begins with a woman who is, I suppose, 25 to 30 years of age, has never been married, criticizing us for not really understanding what it means to be single. And she says, after an introductory comment or two, "We singles lack acceptance because we are, in fact, different from those who are married. For instance, unlike most ladies in my church, I have filled out an income tax form. I've painted my house. I've borrowed money to buy my house. I've put antifreeze in my car. I've insulated my attic. And I've traveled across the country alone. Yet I am frustrated when changing a diaper or making potato salad." You know, they just live in different worlds. "Single men also have unique experiences. When was the last time you saw a man hurry downtown to Penny's annual white sale?" That really says it all, doesn't
it?
She goes on to comment about how her church doesn't understand singles either. The church board decided to create a singles department to try to meet the needs of singles. There were only 9 unmarried people in the church, and their age ranged from 18 to 79. And you can imagine what kind of social fellowship people with that broad of an age range would have just because they have singleness in common. So I thought it was a very articulate letter, and it just began to put some of these things into words.
You wrote and asked for permission then to use her letter.
I did, and she wrote me another one that was even more meaningful.
Good, read it.
She's a very skillful writer in addition to expressing these views that we're very interested in. But in this letter, she talked about how the church and her friends and family and other people around her accidentally, not intentionally, accidentally insult the unmarried person, especially the never married person, with little phrases like this: "God really blessed her. He gave her a husband." Now, what does that say to somebody who's standing there who has never had a husband?
These are phrases she's overheard people saying in church.
That's right. And people aren't even aware how they sting her. And I think that's why we ought to share it with our listeners.
What was another observation she had?
"Father, bless the mothers, fathers, and children that are here today. There's a prayer that excludes a certain group of people that are sitting out there who are neither mothers nor fathers nor children. I've decided singles need Christian fellowship almost as much as marrieds.
Wow.
Which is an interesting comment. Glad to meet you. Do you have a husband around here? Another one says, we're having a Bible study on the beautiful Christian woman. The first section deals with the Christian wife. The last section with the Christian mother. Again, the single is excluded. We're starting a church directory. Please fill in your name on the sheet provided in your bulletin. And, of course, the sheet has slots only for husbands, wives, and children. We're starting a church football team, so men come. And bring your wives, too. See, Gil, what these are illustrating is that the church is often organized and designed primarily for the traditional family, a husband, a wife, and perhaps two or three children. But there are people in the church, and a sizable number and an increasing number, who do not fit that pattern and whose needs are often not met. And there are subtle little ways people in the church have of conveying, you're not one of us. We don't even realize how we are insulting you because of that difference.
Yeah, we can talk about a vocabulary problem, the sensitivity of knowing how to write a statement or pray a prayer, but it really, it goes beyond that. It's a realization that there's a whole category of people out there.
We just need to tune in to other people's needs. Another example she gave, ladies, for our topic of conversation at this banquet, tell the person next to you the most unusual thing that happened at your wedding. Now, you can bet that the writer of this letter didn't dig that out of the air. I mean, it didn't just come out of nowhere. She lived that. Undoubtedly, that happened to her. Another one, our social group for those under 35 years of age is called Pears and Spares.
Mm.
Who wants to be a spare? It's just another little way of conveying an insult.
You know, I notice in that letter, and I've noticed in the attitudes and conversation of some singles that I know, a bit of a bite to what they're saying.
Yeah, that's right.
They're upset. There are agonies there. There are frustrations that it just doesn't seem like anybody is really understanding.
Yeah, and singles are no different from the rest of us in that regard, Gil. If someone continually insulted you and didn't realize it, it would sting a little bit.
Sure.
And you'd be aware of it. And I don't feel great bitterness coming out of this letter. I just hear a woman saying, I have needs that other people are not aware of.
Yeah.
And I really would like them to know where I'm coming from. I received another letter very similar to that. And this is from a totally different writer. Obviously, a different part of the country. They're not even acquainted with each other. But listen to how similar some of these same views are. She said, could you remind Christian couples that there are certain remarks that should never be said to singles? They only wound and hurt. Some of my favorites, are, what a wonderful mother you'd make. Now, to a woman who knows that she may never be a mother and probably won't, that just stings and burns, you know, it's like pouring salt in a wound. Or, why hasn't some smart man snatched you up? At a wedding reception, well, it's your turn next. If they haven't seen you for a while, they grab your left hand and gaze at your ring finger and say, just checking. Or, we'll just have to fix you up, and then they never do. Or, I wish you'd hurry up and get married so I can have some grandchildren. Or, I know the perfect man for you, but they never seem to find him. You know, I hear the same kinds of things coming from enough different people to know that it's not just an isolated problem, but it's something a large number of people feel, especially within the Christian church.
All right, now I want to ask you something that that fits in perfectly right here. We're reading letters from singles who have a sense of agitation about how they're being treated. On the other hand, I was reading a newspaper article that sort of stated the opposite, that there is a growing number of single women, in particular in our society. I think they quoted 40% of adult women in the United States are single today. And the article went on to say, and they're pretty pleased. You know, they're kind of self-sufficient, and they're not too interested in getting shackled with a man who's going to expect to be served the rest of his life or something like that. And they're kind of putting their professional and personal development first and kind of feeling good about the whole thing.
Yeah, they're called now stable singles, and I'm sure that they exist. In fact, I'm sure that there are people who've been listening to us to this point who are not married or they're widowed or they're divorced or separated who are saying, that's not really me. I don't know what they're talking about. I don't feel insulted, and I'm not agitated about being single, and I like who I am, and I like my life, and I enjoy my career, and I don't want children, and I don't want to be married, and I'm not upset, and I don't feel that the church is insulting me. So there are people like that, and probably a large number of them. But I don't believe what you read in that article is true. I don't believe that is the typical emotional reaction to singleness, and certainly our mail does not reflect it. The vast majority of the mail that we get from unmarried people is rather honest in saying that I do need somebody to love, and I do want to be loved by somebody, and I do want to raise children, and I do care about a family, and I'm praying that God will bring that family kind of relationship to me. As a matter of fact, I think that some of those articles that are written like that represent a kind of feminist propaganda, which are saying that women don't really need men. And I don't believe that. God made men for women and women for men. And that's the way it's always been. And when you don't have somebody to love, there's usually a void there. I mean, even in a Christian context, even with a relationship with the Lord, where He is your companion and confidant and your master and you're serving Him, there's still a need for other people. God made us vulnerable to one another. Adam had God, but he said it is not good that man should be alone. He needed Eve, and she needed him. And I think it's going to continue to be that way.
Yeah, that is going some, isn't it, to try to take a position that a woman doesn't need a man, you know, that there's somehow a new breed of women. That's stretching a point, isn't it?
It's part of the battle between the sexes that's going on right now. Obviously, there's a great deal of hostility associated with the women's movement. And who's that hostility directed at if it's not men? Gloria Steinem said, and she was quoted in a number of publications, that today a woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle.
Really?
And that is the idea they would like to convey. I haven't found it true. We really do need each other. And that's why I think we ought to face head on this empty feeling, these needs that exist when people haven't found somebody to love.
Okay, now, in a sense, I know that what we've been doing thus far is kind of setting a stage, because you received a very important and moving letter recently, didn't you, that we want to try to address it with some specific recommendations.
Gail, I received literally hundreds of letters from single people, and I want to share with our listeners one of the most intelligent, I think, that I've ever received. So I think it incorporates all that we've been talking about today. She said, "I wanted to write you to express my thoughts on being single. I apologize for my attitude being so defeatist and critical, and the way that reflects on my church and roommates. I know I should be trusting the Lord to meet my needs, but the way I honestly feel is quite despairing. I'm 27, single, and a computer programmer, and I live with three other women from our church fellowship in which all four of us are very heavily involved. It's a rather unusual church in that everyone spends so much time there. I do too, what with accompanying the adult choir and the children's choir and helping with church suppers, etc. And I love it. But due to the lack of single men there, I feel absolutely stymied as far as ever meeting any marriageable man who would believe the way I do, much less be at all interested in me. Several of my friends have openly declared that they feel called to be single, which I know is a valid lifestyle. I respect them and admire them, but I just feel that I was created to be married and have children. I can see that it's my own fault I am still single, because when I first moved here 6 years ago and started coming to the church, there were plenty of single men around. Basically, I was just so shy and backward socially that while everyone else was marrying, I never attracted any man. There were several fellows that I was interested in over the years and attempted to attract their interest by conversation, cooking, suggesting activities, trying to look pretty, and generally trying to be friendly, but to no avail. Right now there are four single men in the church, none of whom is really a prospect. There are 19 single women in our church, of whom 9 consider themselves called to be single. In terms of trying to meet single men, I have also taken part in activities outside the church, like adult education, a week-long energy and technology conference, softball, and courses toward a master's degree. And I have prayed earnestly, believe me, for a husband and children. To me, there's a great deal of grief associated with the single life. There's real pain in feeling myself to be half of a whole, and longing year after year for the other half. Physically, I feel foreordained to bear babies and give them milk and raise them, but my body, year after year, is barren and dry. In the Bible, barrenness is treated with seriousness and compassion, But in the modern church family, a single woman is expected to keep a stiff upper lip, to keep busy and cheerful, and not ever to complain that female companionship is not sufficient for her needs. I think it is hard for married people to recall this feeling of singleness, as though the joy and new responsibilities and problems of finding a partner has washed away whatever previous distress or despair they experienced. Single women and their problems have a certain invisible quality to married people, unless the woman involved is a blood relative or is continually importuning for help. I think that even in one of your films, if I recall correctly, you asked different groups of people to stand in commitment and covered every category of adults except for single women without children. And Gil, that's correct. As I recall, I invited the single parent to stand and mothers and fathers, but I did forget the unmarried adult. It's also easy to start feeling estranged and physically isolated, like I'm not an ongoing link in the human race. And a kind of an aloof, Ecclesiastes-like despair comes over me. I start thinking, of what use is beauty? For example, my roommate has a pretty face, thick hair, and a good figure, none of which I have, and yet she's older than I am, equally frustrated, and has no boyfriend. Her sister married late and had a retarded son in her late 30s, so the fear of that possibility is kind of an unspoken concern for all of us. I'd like to come back to that point. That's a very important point. Or of what value is intelligence when you get right down to it? I won school awards, got 800 and 900 on various college boards and GRE tests, and it hasn't particularly affected my life. And besides emotionally, just physically, it is a huge burden to be always longing for sexual fulfillment. There are times when my needs are especially pronounced. The world begins to seem like a huge, inexorable snubbing machine, as if all 2 billion men in the world have personally rejected me. My nerves get rawer and rawer, and even a kind glance or act translates as salt in the wound, knowing how transient that kind of interchange has to be. I think one reason I'm writing all this to you is that there is no one else to whom I can express this kind of difficulty who would consider it a normal, acceptable problem. I love our church and feel called there, but our fellowship is very straight-laced in terms of never talking about sex. Once we did have a sermon about sexual purity. That was about 7 or 8 years ago. Really, if there weren't so many babies at church, I would think that I was the only one around that was interested in sex. Except for weddings and a one-act play of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, where the prince kisses Snow White and she wakes up and spits out the poisoned apple, our pastor is the only man in our church that I've ever seen kiss his wife, and that was only because we were celebrating their anniversary. Huh. It was very reassuring to hear you say in one of your films that men really are attracted to women. Anyway, thank you so much for just listening. If you have any pamphlet or advice for someone in my predicament, I would be extremely grateful for it. God bless you.
I'm so glad you brought that letter along, because I can't think of any way that you or I could have told that story in our own words. You've got to be there to write like that.
Gil, I think she said it, that it's very difficult for married people to recall the feelings of singleness, and I agree very much with that. Those of us who are married, perhaps we were married at a very young age, and can hardly remember what it was like prior to our marriage. Seems like we've been married forever.
At least to be a single adult.
Yes.
You know, we went from teenage years to college years, which is a whole set of experiences unto itself, into married life. And we didn't have that bridge in between.
All right, take the person like the woman who wrote this letter and project her back to 12 years of age. And she's just awakened to sexuality and to the possibility of dating and to boys that she used to hate so much. And now all of a sudden they've become so exciting. And her little childish mind begins to fantasize about the possibility of a romantic love. And she watches Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And she's involved with crushes on her teachers and other people. And the years roll by, and now she's 13 and 14 and 15, and no boy has even come up and talked to her. Maybe she's unattractive. Maybe her personality repels boys for whatever reason. She can't explain it. She doesn't know why. She has this great yearning and this great longing down inside to have this special friendship with one of those strange creatures that everybody else is so excited about. But it doesn't happen for her. And she's 16, and comes the night of the big party at school, or a major event in her life where you just have to have a date. I mean, you just have to. And if you don't, you lose status in your own eyes and in the eyes of your peers. But nobody asks. Nobody calls. The phone doesn't ring. And she doesn't have that kind of interaction, doesn't have that kind of support and that kind of affection. Nobody comes up and says, "You're kind of cute. How would you like to go have a Coke with me?" You know, and then she goes into 18 and 19, and by this time there's severe self-doubts there. Who am I? What's wrong with me? Why am I different? Why does it happen to all those other girls? They're not all so attractive. Why have they found boyfriends? Why have I never had one? And she goes into college, and at 19 and 20 and 21, and she graduates from college. She had to pick a major for college as to what she was going to study, but she really didn't want a career. She wanted what she's wanted since she's 12 years old, but it doesn't happen. And she spends 4 years of college, and she's got to go out and be a computer programmer now, or a teacher, or whatever else she decides to do. So she accepts that responsibility and goes out into the world still wanting what she's always wanted. Now she's 25, and she's 26 and 28, and 30 and something is happening. Here comes a new pressure. You not only do not have a husband and a family and little children now, but the years are getting away from you, and you only have maybe 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years left. And everybody knows that if you have children too late in the 30s, you run a higher risk for having a child with Down syndrome or mongolism, a retarded child. And then there comes a point where it's completely out of the possibility after menopause. So that biological pressure begins to roll in, and a certain kind of panic occurs that not only do you not have a husband and children now, but you're destined to a life of loneliness and rejection.
That's a vivid picture that you've painted of the experience of so many singles, I'm sure. Doctor, we need to turn a corner here. And I want to ask you if you have any suggestions or recommendations for people who are caught up in that kind of a cycle.
Gil, it would be glib to imply that I could just wipe out the years of frustration with 2 or 3 very brief comments. You know, we have painted this picture, and it is very real, and people feel it every day. And I don't want to imply now that I've just got all the answers, and you take 2 little green ones and a blue one, and that's the end of it. But I do have some thoughts on the subject, and maybe this will be of some help to people who are there.
Good.
First, I happen to know that there are both men and women who are in the same boat, who feel like I've described. They're desperately searching for each other, and I know they're both out there because I get letters from both of them. And the same loneliness that causes a woman to say, "Where's the man of my dreams? Where is the man to fill my life?" There's a man sitting out there who's asking the same questions and has the same needs. And so the problem for both of them is finding one another. And if I wanted one thing, marriage, more than anything else in the world, I would pull out all stops to find it. I'd make any sacrifice necessary to find it, whether it meant changing churches, changing cities, finding a new job, making a financial sacrifice, starting over, traveling, whatever's necessary. If it's really that important to you, if you really care about that factor above all else, then I would not sit in one place, one church, and just hope for some miracle to come along. I would set about finding it, or better yet, finding him or her. Now, at the start of such a search, I think I would pray the prayer that said, "Lord, I'm going to make a concerted effort for 2 years to push on all the doors around me. I'm going to give it everything I've got, and if you have somebody out there for me, help me find them, because they may be looking for me too. Bring us together." But at the end of that period of time, if I have not found anybody, and if the search has been unsuccessful, I will accept what you have for me and for my life, and to the best of my ability, I will put myself into your hands and release this dream and plan a different kind of life for myself.
That's an interesting bit of counsel, but isn't it hard? Isn't it frustrating? A Christian can't frequent a singles bar or other means of locating an eligible partner?
I would definitely not recommend singles going to singles bars, because a certain kind of person goes there, and those kind of people are typically not committed, strong, believing Christians. And if that's the kind of marriage you want, and I would hope it is, then you go to the places where they are found, at other singles groups, at churches, at colleges, at other functions where you're likely to find people who have the same kind of faith that you do.
But you would go so far as even changing churches as a part of searching for that person.
If it was that important to me, I would.
What do you think keeps people from doing just that?
Lack of confidence, in some cases a lack of courage, other cases a lack of resources. You know, it takes money, and many single people barely pay for an apartment and all those expenses that they have anyway. And it's scary, and it's difficult to move to a new city or a new place. It's easier to just get into the rut and continue doing what you've always done and just hope for a miracle, hope that the door is going to spring open someday and that dream person is going to walk in.
A person in this situation feels like nobody wants him. No point in getting out there because I'm not going to be well received.
Yes, and I think all of us feel that way to some degree. The single just has it focused on the matter of the family and marriage, but I hear the same kind of things from women who are married and from husbands who are dissatisfied with their work and their jobs and wonder where they're going, those in midlife crisis and all the rest. We all have to do the same thing, Gil, and you've heard me recommend this before, but it boils down to this. Do everything you can to make your life as meaningful and as fulfilling as possible. But there are circumstances in everyone's life that we're unhappy with and that would be different if we could change it. But the secret to mental health is not having all of those things removed, every barrier, every hardship. The secret to mental health is in accepting life as it is. And it's not just the single that that comment is addressed to. Some of our listeners right now are blind, and they have to accept the fact that they're blind and will probably always be blind. Some are older widows, and they're very lonely and needy, and they remember those happy days when they were raising children and the husband was alive. And my own mother is in that category. Some are wives of very cold and unresponsive husbands. Some have cancer. Our world is filled with imperfection and sorrow and loneliness, Gil, but these people make it. They cope. They survive because they have to. And ultimately, that's the attitude that I think any frustrated person has to take. With God's help, I will make it.
All right, then, give a very personal message as we wrap up this discussion to the single who's listening who may be feeling some of these things. Maybe even the woman who wrote us is listening today.
All right, let me say to that one person whom we've been describing, perhaps you're lonely, you're longing for a husband or wife. You've had those deep desires and longings that have been frustrated for 10 or 15 or 20 years. You're sick unto death of your roommate or roommates, and you feel a lot of what we've been talking about. Let me remind you that God loves you. He cares for you. He has not forgotten you. You are still His child. He created you. He has a place for you, and you are more important than the worth of the entire world. And because of that, you will live someplace in eternity. And this life is, after all, a brief staging ground for a more beautiful world to come. I think it's very important not to forget that this is not permanence here. This is just a preparation. That's the heart of the Christian message. But we get so wrapped up in it that we forget that the Christians have the hope of a more beautiful life that's going to follow this one, which will not be segregated by those married and those that are unmarried.